Today on Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at Ghana. 60 years after becoming the first black African country to regain her political independence. During the past six decades, Ghana has experienced both great challenges and opportunities. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali.
And hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Ayan Bior, your social media reporter.
Today, we'll talk about the challenges and opportunities during the 60 years that Ghana has been politically independent.
And coming up later in our STA inbox, our audience has weighed in on our topic through emails and Facebook and Twitter comments. We'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
The West African nation of Ghana, which regained her political independence 60 years ago, is a beacon of hope for African democracy. My colleague, Paul Sisko, has more.
Black Africa's first independent nation celebrated its 60th anniversary last week. Ghana secured its independence from Britain on March 6, 1957. The nation's father and first president, Kwame Nkrumah, was a founding member of the Organization of African Unity, now the African Union, and the most visionary, influential voice in the Pan-African movement in the early years of Ghana's independence. Over the last six decades, Ghana has transitioned from military dictatorships to becoming a well-functioning democracy. On his first sub-Saharan Africa trip as president, President Obama met with then-President John Atta Mills and addressed the Ghanaian parliament. Nkrumah was overthrown in 1966 and four military takeovers ensued in 1972, 78, 79, and 1981. Ghanaians eventually cast aside the authoritarian politics of its past, with a succession of democratic elections beginning in 1993. According to the 2016 Global Peace Index, Ghana is now one of the most peaceful places on earth, ranking more peaceful than both France and Great Britain. Nana Akufo-Addo was sworn in as president, defeating incumbent John Dramani Mahama on January 8, 2017. He's promising prosperity for all Ghanaians.
But we can all see the desperation of our young people. They want to work, but there are no jobs, and some of them are being driven to unacceptable behavior. We have a veritable time bomb on our hands.
Ghana has now held several successful presidential elections. In the last few years, it has made significant progress reducing poverty and improving the general well-being of its people. As a health care provider, it ranks among the most impressive in sub-Saharan Africa. But maintaining peace, furthering nationwide development, and democracy building are never-ending tasks. Ghana is currently under an International Monetary Fund bailout because of its budget deficit, rising inflation, and high rate of unemployment. Today, after more than 60 years traversing a dignified path to peace and democracy, Ghana's maturing democracy stands as a shining light of freedom in the region and in the world. Paul Sisko, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining us here in our Washington studio is Ni Akwete, policy analyst and activist on Africa. And joining us by telephone from New York is Dr. James Jonah, former United Nations Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Ghanaian Information Minister Mustafa Hamid was scheduled to participate in today's discussion, but due to circumstances beyond his control, he could not join us. Well, gentlemen, I have to say frankly that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to, you know, to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Shaka, it's a privilege and a special privilege that you invited me here today, especially to talk about the 60 years of Ghana's independence. So thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Of course, you are very, very welcome. Always, Dr. James Jonah.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate what you're doing about Ghana. Because you may not know it, many of us young Africans at the time were so much impressed with what Ghana was doing, and much of our life was shaped what was happening in Ghana in the late 1950s and beyond.
I see. Thank you very much. Later in the program, we will give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111. The U.S. country code is 1. Let me come to you immediately, Nia Kuwete. After all, you happen to be a gallant Ghanaian yourself,
yes,
the son of the soil.
Yes.
When someone talks about 60 years of political independence for Ghana, what comes to mind immediately, really? What has that, in fact, meant, really, for Ghana as a country?
Well, it has meant more or less a new birth on March 6, 1957, when Ghanaians got control of their country. They wrested the control. But then what do we do with the control and the freedom and the opportunities and the challenges we've had? So the first thing that comes to mind is, because I do remember the day, March 6, 1957. I do remember even the night before at the old polo ground where they held a nighttime rally. My parents wouldn't allow me to go because there was too big a crowd. So I that scene is in my mind. It's indelible. But then you ask, what has happened since then? Of course, from 1957 to 1966, we had 9 years of rule by Dr. Nkrumah and the CPP, and then he was overthrown. We had 3 years of military rule. Then Professor Busia came in as prime minister, and he was overthrown 2 years later. Then we got a whole stream of coups until 1981 with the Jerry Rawlings coup, and then we went democratic in 1992 under a new constitution. And fortunately, we haven't had any interruption of our democracy. Maybe I should even use the word fortunate, because this was actually done by Ghanaians. It wasn't luck. It was hard work and hard thinking by Ghanaians that we have tried one-party systems, we have tried military coups, and what is best for the people of Ghana is to be able to hire their political leaders and fire them when they are not performing well. That's how we arrived at democracy, and I think that is so important. On a personal level, I mean, President Akufo-Addo, just in the clip we saw, talked about the importance of economic growth, mm-hmm. and the youth and time bomb. I think economic growth is hugely important. Now, Ghana is part of Africa, and in the parts of the continent, we also see wars and terrorism. So security is also important. So I'm saying economics is important, security is important, but I have written and I still maintain that the first primary important thing is to make sure we have democracy. Because with democracy, then you can pursue all the other things. So I am very proud of Ghana and Ghanaians that they have established democracy in 1992. It also made me extremely proud of the former president of the United States that within 6 months of being in power, he went to Africa, of all places, not his father's country of Kenya, but Ghana, and he went to Ghana because of Ghana's democracy. So if you ask me, 60 years, yes, there have been opportunities and slip-ups, but the greatest achievement for me is, one, gaining our independence, and two, establishing democracy.
I have to remind you, by the way, that President Obama did not go to Ghana first, in as far as Africa is concerned.
Yes.
He first went, guess where?
Egypt. Absolutely. He went to Egypt. I do agree with that totally. And part of my work here is to say that Egypt is part of Africa, so that is true. On the other hand, knowing how American politics works, he went to Egypt because the Middle East is such an important, almost number one on America's security concerns in the whole world. Every American president, regardless of where his forebears are from, takes the Middle East, Egypt, Syria, Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia. That area is so important to them. So, yes, it is true he went to Egypt first. In fact, the current president, Mr. Trump, the first African he called was General Sisi in Cairo. He's called him several times. Before, he talked to Mr. Buhari in Nigeria and Mr. Zuma in South Africa.
I see.
Yes.
Dr. Jonah, you obviously have been following Ghana even before it became Ghana, when it was the Gold Coast. Why is it that sometimes Ghana's independence is referred to by some people as the first to be independent in sub-Saharan Africa, when in fact the records will show that Sudan got independence a year earlier, in 1956?
Well, you know, the colonial policy at that time was really to separate North Africa from Africa south of the Sahara. In fact, even today, you find the same division in the United Nations, in UNDP. They treat the North Africans differently. When I was Minister of Finance, I discovered that when meetings were held in the IMF and World Bank, they separate the North Africans from the Southern African. So this is why it was said they were referring to Black Africa. That was the main reason. But Nkrumah, and this I want to stress, I know people have been very critical of the administration of Nkrumah, but what I can say is that he made the proper diagnosis of the problem for Africa. And what do I mean by that? He understood, as he said, unless the independence for all of Africa, then Ghana itself will not be independent. That was one of his things. Secondly, he understood the problems of tribalism. Okay, his solution was to have a united Ghana, and maybe the way he went about it was not right. Another thing which has not been fully analyzed is the traumatic experience of Nkrumah and many Africans in the Congo. The death and the manner in which Lumumba died really created shock for them. They realized for the first time that the international system is a very treacherous place. And maybe the answers which they found, for example, moving towards a one-party system and then going very firstly towards socialism as the mainstay to stimulate the economy, may have ended differently, but their diagnosis is still true. Today, Africa is not industrialized, which means we have a lot of problems with trade. We're still based on commodities, and that's one thing which Nkrumah and others were trying to resolve. The issue of energy, even today, throughout Africa, the problem of electricity is a major one. With his Volta project, they were trying to resolve all this issue. But I think the circumstances for them were very, very challenging. And maybe that's why they were not so successful.
Very interesting. What about the fact that, I guess I'll put that question to you later, because time happens not to be my best ally right now. Let's pause for a short break, but first, we want to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now streaming on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa and watch our show live. And don't forget to share it with your friends. Also, we are on Twitter and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka. And join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOAGhanaIs60. We'll put some of your tweets on air later in the show. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Dr. Jonah, these days when people gain power or they succeed at becoming presidents of their countries, some of them, the first thing they talk about is that they have in fact killed their animal, their beast. And others, of course, celebrate and all that kind of stuff because it probably means that they are no longer having any relationship with poverty. Any particular reason why Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, on March 6, 1957, the key of the speech was that the independence of Ghana would be meaningless unless it is linked with the total liberation of Africa? And he did not simply talk the talk, but in fact, he walked the talk so that Africa could walk the walk.
Let's look at that one, because I followed Nkrumah's rule very carefully, even as a student. The first coup, and that coup was quite a landmark in Africa. It came, let us forget, not forget, that it came after Wilfred Boigny and others accused Nkrumah of formulating, in that time, terrorism in Africa. And this accused him of having brought Chinese to train terrorists in Ghana. Okay? And then that created problem for other powers. You know, the French concern in Africa was the fear that the epidemic effect of Nkrumah might spread to its friends in the Afro-Francophone areas. And don't forget that shortly after that incident, and when he took that step, I was then in the UN advising on Vietnam, and when he was going to go to North Vietnam, and you at that time in night, it was like dynamite to say it, and then it was on his way when he reached to Beijing that he was overthrown. So there are a lot of factors that really affected him, but he was quite correct because, and that's why he played such a role in the Congo, because you know when the Congo dispute started in 1960, Ghana troops were the first to be there, and he was most energetic. But then he realized, look, the situation in the Congo was bigger than he had thought, and therefore that's why he pushed very much for the urgent creation of the Organization of African Unity. So these are the problems, and I said his diagnosis of the situation of Africa was good. Maybe the way it was resolved was a problem, but it means well. You were talking recently about the split, say, within the Middle East. What did Nkrumah did? Nkrumah had experience in Europe where you have countries unite by marriages. So he chose an Egyptian woman to marry. Not that he could not find someone in Ghana, but he was trying to unify both the Arab North and the rest of Africa. So I am one of those who even though I may see some of the mistakes he made, to really give him great credit for his vision for Africa.
Very interesting. Now, Ni Akwete, yes. Kwame Nkrumah obviously becomes one of the founding fathers of the Organization of African Unity,
yes,
in 1963.
Yes.
And yet, he was, in fact, an advocate for the United States of Africa.
Yes.
How much would you say he probably was influenced by the experience of going to school and living in the United States for about 10 years?
I think it influenced him a great deal. I think if you look at his personal experiences, where he studied, where he even taught for a while, like Howard University, it influenced him a great deal. It also he was also influenced by his immersion into the struggles of African Americans. In fact, no less a person than Nwalimu Julius Nyerere. I have read him saying that, in fact, if you look at the independence leaders, the Africa's founding fathers, Nkrumah was one of the most radical, meaning he was in a hurry. Even internally in Ghana, when people were saying eventual self-government, he was saying we want independence now. Nkrumah was in a hurry, and according to Nwalimu Julius Nyerere, the reason was his experience in the United States. Julius Nyerere said, you know, I went to school in Scotland. Many of other people went to school in the UK. We came out as gradualists. Nkrumah was in a hurry. He got that from the African Americans and his experience in the United States. He made him say, we want independence right away. We want to unite very quickly, because if Africa doesn't unite, I mean, you ask His Excellency Dr. Jonah about Nkrumah saying that the independence of Ghana is meaningless unless it's linked up with the total liberation of Africa. That is so true, because the other thing that he talked about, one of the first big words I learned in school, was because Nkrumah was always on the radio talking about balkanization of Africa. So I had to look up what balkanization means, which means the colonialists deliberately carved Africa into little, small, weak states to divide us, to keep us weak.
Did that remind you of the Berlin Conference of 1885?
Yes, it did.
Bismarck?
Yes, yes. Otto von Bismarck called this conference in Berlin, and basically it was the European colonialists, but America, the United States, had representation there. And the argument simply was, yes, they called Africa a ripe cake. I mean, a ripe watermelon or a cake that they wanted to carve up. Mm. But they said, let us not kill ourselves over Africans. Let us just sit down on a map and draw up which parts of the continent we will take. This is what they did. And, of course, it affected Nkrumah a great deal, and the various leaders of the founders of Africa. So this is the reason why Pan-Africanism, which has roots in the United States, but also is deeply rooted in Africa, is to return Africa to being one people, not carved into little countries that then are encouraged to be suspicious of each other, to compete. And I think, you know, since we are talking about what has Ghana and Africa achieved in 60 years, of course, we haven't achieved paradise. I was reading, once you invited me, I was reading up on a few things, and I noticed Ghanaian public opinion is actually very self-critical, Shaka. If mm-hmm. you read it, they are saying, what have we done with our 60 years? You know, we have too much poverty, we have too much corruption. But I'm saying the other side of the ledger is that we have achieved some important things too, and we should not forget those.
Now, talk to us about what you have achieved. If someone asked you, for example, that you name, or you put your finger on what you would consider to be the single most important accomplishment during the last 60 years of Ghanaian independence, what would you say?
Let me say again, securing our independence. You know, there are so many stories told about Nkrumah and how he fought with the British. And some of them you realize might be apocryphal. It's hard to find the exact situation. But one of them that I like is, basically, I'm told that the British were saying to him, no, you don't want independence right now. You are not ready. You will make mistakes. And he says, Not only may we make mistakes, I guarantee you we will make mistakes, but those will be our mistakes. Thus far, for over 100 years of colonialism in Ghana and even involvement before that, we have been making the mistakes of the British and the Europeans. So our greatest achievement, in my mind, no question about it, is that we get to run our own affairs, we make our own mistakes, and we correct them. We don't want to make someone else's mistakes.
Very interesting. Dr. Jonah, of course...
Can I come in?
Yes, please.
Now, one thing which I think Ghanaians should be proud of is that the Ghana experience really made it for a lot of Africans who are not even in Ghana. In Sierra Leone, I can tell you, it was a whole generation that was really transformed by the experience of Ghana. Even when we were taking our exam, we look at CPP, the way we used to put it, chew, pass, pour, and pass. So it was a mixed stipulation. But also what I think we should not forget is the influence of Pan-Africanism on Nkrumah. Something was mentioned, something which he picked up in London. People like Garvey and others, who, and he kept it on. Even when he became independent, he brought a lot of these people to Ghana. And so he has that. And then I want to say something which is very interesting. Today, if you look at Mugabe is one of those people who was tremendously influenced by Nkrumah. And his wife, who was Ghanaian, you look, if you map out Mugabe, he has a stable governance while she was with him. So these are the kinds of influence which Nkrumah had, and really for so many people today, even though they can say, yes, maybe he made a mistake here and there. And even in Ghana, there are a lot of Ghanaians, I can tell you, who were trained under Nkrumah, who still maintain that determination and stability and courage that Nkrumah exhibited.
Very interesting. You earlier mentioned, of course, how Nkrumah said, perhaps because of being educated in the United Kingdom, he actually became a member of the Gradualist. Wouldn't that remind you of someone also equally important in as far as your country is concerned, one of the big six?
Yes.
J.B. Dankwa?
Yes, yes.
University of London.
Yes, yes. As we were saying off the air, he was named the doyen of Ghanaian politics.
Correct.
In fact, the current administration of Ghana, the Akufo-Addo administration, you can very easily trace the New Patriotic Party to the UGCC that was the political party, that invited Nkrumah to come to Ghana. He arrived back in Ghana from the UK, as Dr. Jonah said. After studying in the United States, he went to Great Britain. They held, the fourth Pan-Africanist Congress.
Yes.
And then he was invited by a Ghanaian friend, of course, a Gold Coaster then, Akuajay, who then later became his foreign minister. He recommended him to J.B. Dankwa and the Big Six, and they invited him to come and run the program to wrestle Ghana's governance from the British for Ghanaians, for Gold Coasters, as it were.
Invited him to run the secretariat, as Secretary General, correct?
Right, that's right, which mm-hmm. means he was running affairs every day. They were like the board, and they would direct him and fund him and finance him. Of course, there was a split. Basically, we don't know. People have different versions of the story, but one of the ones that I embrace is that there was a difference in strategy. There was a difference in how fast to go. Nkrumah wanted to go much faster. The UGCC disagreed, so Nkrumah broke away and formed the CPP, the political party. And because he had been running affairs and going to all kinds of villages, I mean, my mother and older sisters and brothers would tell me he would come and sleep in villages.
The good news, of course, is that, yes, they did have, of course, fundamental, perhaps philosophical and ideological disagreements.
Yes.
But they did agree on one thing.
Yes.
That the Gold Coast on attaining political independence, it should be named Ghana.
Yes.
A reflection of the ancient, you know, African Ghanaian Empire.
I think that is so important. I think even to me, it has reverberations today in Africa and even among the African community here. Basically, it says the idea that Europeans should govern us and yes. speak for us
yes.
is bunk. We don't buy it. We speak for ourselves. We are proud of our culture. Nkrumah used to have a Christian name. He dropped it.
Well,
so a lot of people who are like me, who went to school during his time, we said, you don't need a so-called Christian name to be a Christian. Your Ghanaian name is fine.
Unfortunately, the time is not of this ally.
Yes.
You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, including our social media segment. So please, don't go away.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders. They are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them. Today, not tomorrow. So let's connect. Let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies. Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known. It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Straight Talk Africa on The Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111. And the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Ewart. And of course, this is Straight Talk Africa coming to you from the Voice of America. And of course, here now, it's time to bring in my colleague and social media reporter, Ayen Bior. Take it away, Ayen.
Thanks, Shaka. We received tremendous feedback on our social media platforms to this week's question. After years of suffering under British colonial rule, Ghana became the first African nation to achieve independence in 1957. Now, 60 years later, we'll review how its precedent inspired other nations to seek their sovereignty. This leads us to our question of the week, which asked, after 60 years, how has Ghana fared as an independent state? Well, before we begin, I'd like to thank everyone that used our social media platforms to communicate with us. And another reminder that we are tweeting live today. Use the hashtag VOAGhanaIs60. And if you haven't yet, please follow us at VOAShaka. And speaking of, let's go to a tweet from Frank Nero, who tweets, Ghana's only achievement is corruption, greediness, and selfishness. And Frank expands in a second tweet. He adds, if you compare the natural resources we have, we must achieve much more than this. And now to our comment of the week from Facebook fan Ibrahim Magara in Nairobi, Kenya. He says, Ghana has experienced steady progress in democratization, although the pace is rather slow. I think it could grow a little faster. However, compared to its peers, the country has done well. Unfortunately, the democratic transition in Ghana has not been reflected in the betterment of the majority of the people. The country needs to devise ways through which the fruits of democratic transformation will reflect in a better economy, a more accountable and responsive government, and better lives for the people. Now let's go to another comment from Facebook fan Ayide David Achu, who writes, Ghana has made tremendous growth in terms of democracy, human rights, and transition of power, but the country's progress has been marred by corruption in governance. And our last Facebook comment comes from Patricia Nambi in Kampala, Uganda. She writes, Kwame Nkrumah turned Ghana into a base for Pan-Africanism, and he organized conferences in 1958 in Accra, encouraging Africans to adopt a radical approach to eliminate colonialism from Africa. Ghana and Nkrumah became an apostle of the non-alignment policy. He wanted to stamp out neocolonialism in Africa. He even proposed the formation of the United States of Africa. Ghana has played a significant role in the decolonization of Africa. Very interesting. Now, a reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback, so please keep them coming. And if you're a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Interact with our show as it's streaming live. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com, or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV 2 Africa and follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. Also, remember that Straight Talk Africa is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website, or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program. On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss Africa land reform. The World Bank says that Africa needs to change its systems for buying and selling land. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa. Well, that's all for today's social media segment. Shaka, you and the guest have a lot of social media comments to discuss. Back to you.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Ayen, and welcome back to our discussion on the challenges and opportunities during the 60 years that Ghana has been politically independent. Our guests today are Nni Akwete, policy analyst and activist in Africa, and Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General. Well, again, gentlemen, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
We cannot thank you enough for having us over and for talking about this particular issue. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Now, Dr. James Jonah, you obviously listened at least to the social media comments. Your reaction?
Well, this is true. I know that corruption is very, very deep in Africa society and African governance. But I want to give a note of caution. Corruption is a global problem. The only difference is that whereas in the developed countries you have massive corruption, the system can absorb it. In Africa, corruption is very deadly to the common people. And that's the difference. Secondly, we have to take into account that most of these corrupt practices are brought from outside in terms of contracts and everything. So I think it's true to say, yes, corruption has been very, very, very rife. But there are other problems which I think Africans should take into account. I have been surprised, for example, in 2014, Al Jazeera gave a very interesting documentary. And that documentary was about the Jacques-Oka connection in Africa, which was most devastating to African governance. Coups were planned in Paris. All kinds of things were done. So these are things which we should not forget that has also caused a lot of problems. So, yes, we should continue the fight against corruption. In many African countries, they have anti-corruption commissions. But the poverty that we experience today in Africa will make it a current task to end corruption in Africa. So those critics, and none of them African critics, should not throw the baby with the bath. To realize what Africans are trying to achieve, to understand the context in which they are operating, and thirdly, the external influences, what I call the very treacherous environment that African leaders have to operate today.
Very interesting. Girl, what about you, Neo Kwete?
Yes, I think it's so interesting that Dr. Jonah picked on the very first comment on corruption. That also struck me, and I agree with everything that he said. I want to add one more to it.
What about the way he relates it to coups, for example, where, in fact, it takes two to tango?
Yes.
It does not take one.
There
is a dynamic between somewhere in Europe.
Yes.
And in Africa.
Yes, he mentioned Jacques Foucault, who was this advisor to French presidents. And he wrote a book claiming that virtually everyone who became a president in a Francophone country, he interviewed that person in Paris to make sure that they will serve French interests. There are instances where leaders in many African countries will fill suitcases with diamonds and hard currency and give it to French presidents to use to run their affairs. So, yes, the corruption has linkages with the outside system. As we speak now, one of the things that impresses me about former President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa is that he has done wonderful work on what are called illegal financial flows. And he has confirmed that every year as we speak, not yesterday, not 60 years ago, not 10 years ago, today as we speak, corrupt international system siphons illegally out of Africa $60 billion, 60 with a billion with a B. Money taken out of Africa illegally. If that money can be retained, it will very much help develop Africa. We have to find a way to embarrass the international players who do this. But to get to corruption in Ghana and in Africa, yes, it is a big problem. Yes, it is there. And people must not forget it's connected to the outside. But the one thing I want to add to it is, okay, so how do we fight it?
Precisely.
What is the most effective way of fighting corruption?
Why is it, in fact, that some African leaders, if you call them that, because, frankly, I don't see how those are African leaders,
yes,
who, frankly, play ball.
Yes.
They play ball
such
an extent that they become, in fact, wearing victims, if you will.
Absolutely. If you look at Africa's history, it's heartbreaking. If you love Africa, if you are an African, 500 years of slavery, colonialism, neocolonialism, and of course, this $60 billion I'm talking about every year as we speak, as you rightly point out, is taken out with the connivance of powerful Africans. But here is my solution. I think leadership is important. It's really important. We need good leaders. But I don't put my hope in good leaders. I put my hope in institutions, okay? My life in the United States, what I've seen is, this may be heresy to some, but I think the average American politician is no less corrupt than the one in Africa. The fact is that the Americans have institutions and processes so that even if you have a low IQ and you are in politics, you understand that the risk of being caught is very, very high. There are institutions, there are media, there are crusaders. So in Africa, my solution is, yes, if we get leaders with good character, that is great. If we get leaders that are incorruptible, that is great. But we shouldn't rely on that. We should build institutions.
So how do you do that? Because in fact, the first thing you have to do, if in order to talk about institutions,
yes,
you have to transform yourself into a society of laws.
Precisely.
Not a society of men or women.
Yes.
In this particular case, you have individuals, really,
right,
who personify,
yes,
what you call institutions.
Which is why I am saying those are not institutions. Those are individuals. We need alternative. By institution, I mean processes. I mean organizations. Yes. And to me, you know, power corrupts. And power corrupts Africans as well as anybody else. So we should not rely on them. We, the people, ordinary Africans, ordinary Ghanaians, must understand that we have to find ways to create the processes that will hold our leaders in check. I think it's a fundamental mistake to think that we will look to the leaders to behave themselves and to have good hearts. No, it's like a bank. You don't say that you think that the bank robber should have a change of heart. You have processes that will stop the bank robber and that will catch him if he attempts it. We need institutions, and they are embedded in democracy, which is why I am such a fan of democracy. You know, there are some African countries, there are people...
You probably first have to get education. So that people, in fact, can be, let's face it, people need to be politically conscious. Well, they need to be conscious of who they are, who their power is, really.
Well, it depends. I will agree with you if we can agree on the definition of education. I don't think it's just sitting in a classroom. Okay, education comes in all forms, and there are people yes. who may not have sat in a classroom, but are very much aware and have good character. I've met such people.
Unfortunately, so, there's no democracy in Studio 52.
Yes,
when they
of
say
course.
You have to go. A reminder that you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. To participate in our discussion, please call us at 202-619-3111. This country code is 1. We'll continue our discussion in a moment, so please, don't go away.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA. If you like today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook, keywords Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githu Ewart, and of course, this is Straight Talk Africa coming to you live from Washington. Now, Dr. Jonah, what about you coming in? How do we build institutions in a situation where you have these very powerful, strong individuals who pretty much are more or less like institutions in their own right?
Africa began with a lot of charismatic leaders, of which Nkrumah was one. I agree that it is important to build institutions. But as you said, you need a lot of education. But I personally was very much impressed the first time I met Mwalimu.
Julius Nyerere.
And it was in 1975. Mm-hmm. I went to a visit with then Secretary General Waldheim. And I couldn't believe when we were invited to a state dinner to see the way he came to that dinner. I was shocked because I've never seen this with all my association with African presidents. Very simple, live commonly without... And he set an example, and people forget that during the time of Mwalimu, there was very little corruption going on in Tanzania. He set an example. Things are changing now. So that's a possibility that can do that. Secondly, I think that we have to look, I want to go back to this treacherous environment in which African leaders operate today. Let me give you just two examples. African leaders today are faced with rules which are made outside of their control. The World Bank, the IMF have rules. You have to obey those rules. And if you don't obey those rules, you are going to be in trouble. You have WTO. You have to obey those rules. And somebody asked me a question. I said, why doesn't the ANC government deal with the land problem, which is so poor for the Africans? Why didn't they act? I said to them, first, look at what happened to Mugabe when he tried.
Yes.
And he said, well, what would they do to him? I said, within 2 weeks, there might be flight of capital. The currency, the rand will drop in value. These are the way they discipline African leaders today. And this creates very, very serious problems. But again, these circumstances of winning elections in Africa are rather difficult. Because elections are won in Africa on tribal basis and regional basis, and it is very difficult for any rational politician who make rational calculations to win an election in Africa. These are the factors which make it so much difficult. And therefore, people find all means to win power, and when they win power, they want to pay back.
Shaka.
Very interesting, very interesting. You know, let me take you back to earlier, again to Mwalimu Julius Kambarage Nyerere of Tanzania.
Yes.
A man, arguably, who is now in the race for, in fact, becoming a saint.
Yes, so I hear, because he was a Catholic.
He was not only a Catholic, but a very good Catholic.
Okay.
So much that, in fact, he failed to be a very good socialist.
I see.
Now, you know, you talked about how he said because of his education in the United Kingdom, he ended up being a gradualist.
Compared to Osagyefo.
That is correct. I think he has a point, because when you look at the life of the Osagyefo is an undergraduate student, is attending some meetings presided over by a Father Divine in New York City.
Yes.
You have a Jamaican-born Marcus Garvey.
Yes.
And later, he's in a very good company of Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois and George Padmore.
Du Bois is buried in Laboni, Accra.
I have been to his grave several times.
Yes.
Yes. And there is, of course, a George Padmore library.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. No, I think you are so right. Nkrumah was acutely conscious and a very good student of the international environment, both leading to and after the Second World War. In fact, he came to the United States, if I'm not mistaken, in 1935. So he was here throughout the war, went to Britain in 1945. So he was acutely aware, and he made all these important connections and friends, Padmore, Du Bois, and in fact, the first time I heard Marcus Garvey's name, I read it in an Nkrumah book. He talked about these people all the time. But if you will permit me, Dr. Jonah has made a particular point about three times, and each time I say I will endorse, I forget, which is the difficult global circumstance under which Africans came to power. Let me say again, as Ghanaian, when I was reading the Ghana papers just yesterday, I said, my goodness, I keep forgetting how critical Ghanaians are of themselves.
But we keep talking about Africa and the circumstances and what have you. What about when you go to the brothers in Asia? What about when you go to Singapore?
Oh, but
what about you go to Malaysia?
Shaka, I'm so glad you say that, because I've heard that argument over and over and over. People will tell you South Korea and Ghana became independent in 1957. Singapore, yesterday I was reading someone also who was saying, he told the professor, no, we need to do better, because when you go to Singapore, a city-state, they do so well, and they got independence from Britain before
1965, after.
But I disagree with that argument for this reason. We were not starting at the same place. Asia was not colonized to the extent that Africa was colonized. Asia did not have its people.
You mean India was not colonized?
Just a second. Here is another word. I said to the extent. But here is the thing. How many millions of Africans were shipped over to the United States? That's a second point. So Africa was climbing out of a deeper hole. And the third point is this. People forget the Cold War. Asia was the front line of the Cold War. The United States was fighting communism in Vietnam. So it made a deliberate decision. We are going to help our allies succeed, not democratically, but helping them with investment and things so that they can be prosperous, so that Asians will not go communist. In Africa, they fought the Cold War too, but they have a very different strategy. The strategy was, we will find a dictator, and if he says he's anti-communist, we'll give him money and guns and support him to kill people.
And supported Mobutu Sese Seko for 32 years.
So the people who
have anything changed if you look at the Great Lakes region?
No, in fact, it's still boiling, because now we have the United States still supporting dictators in the Great Lakes, and they do it a double standard. They wink at others and put pressure on others. My point is that argument that Asia, after independence, did better than Africa is a facile debate. You need to dig deeper. Africa had greater obstacles.
I'm afraid I have to give Dr. Jonah the last word.
Yes.
Well, if I can, I think the question of Singapore is very interesting. I happen to know Lee Kuan Yew, and a man I respect a great deal. But people forget that throughout the administration of Lee Kuan Yew, he was condemned by the West as a dictator throughout. And the first time he said, I don't care what they call, I'm just going to run my country the way I think. So this is the problem. The problem is what was good for him in Singapore, if they were unified. In Africa, if you have somebody like Lee Kuan Yew, unfortunately, he or she will be undermined by Africans who are enticed from the outside. That's the problem for Africa.
But Singapore also, Singapore had, of course, his own Chinese.
Yes.
He had the Indians.
Right.
And he had the Malays.
Yes.
But they were unified.
Yes,
they were unified under Lee Kuan Yew.
He had to do a lot, in fact, to bring up the Malays, who were the majority, and yet socially and economically disadvantaged.
No, what they did was, you have the Malay. He broke away from Malaysia. That's what they did.
Yes, but he still had...
Singapore. It is not easy for him. I know him very well. We have sat down with him and discussed while I was in the UN in my visit, discussed with him. He has a clear idea where he wants to go. You know, and as I said, he was unified. There are no very few detractors of the people from East, from outside, yes.
What about
from inside?
What about the African
Africa today?
What about the African example? You go to Botswana.
You have a strong leader, and he will be brought down by his own people.
What about Botswana, where Sir Sekama made a difference to Botswana?
Yes, but can I answer that? I know him too. You see, his good governance was very under him because of his own experience. Okay, and Botswana was blessed with many good presidents. I will not say that for now, but Botswana had very good leaders throughout, which was set by Segese Kama because of his own. You all know the history. There's a theme now, which is about that.
I see.
So I think that you can have it, but Africans must know how to support their leaders when they are taking independent positions.
I see. Well, on that note, thanks to our two distinguished guests, Ni Akwete, policy analyst and activist on Africa, and Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, who joined us via telephone link up from New York. Thanks to affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, Today Break Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Ghana. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.